The Zone Coverage Podcast Network.
Hey, this is Chris Jimenez, and you're listening to Midwest Swing on the Zone Coverage Podcast Network.
You can put it on the board!
Woo!
What up? We're back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We are part of the Zone Coverage Podcast Network, which can be found on Twitter at Zone Coverage MN. I'm your host, Brandon Warren. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon_Warren. And today, we are coming at you from the St. Michael, Minnesota branch of Zone Coverage. Yes, we are recording from my home. I'm using my own software here. So if it sounds a little worse than when we're in the studio, people can please feel free to reach out, but this allows us to be a little bit more productive in terms of getting out more shows, shorter shows, more varied shows. So we are always open to questions, queries, quandaries, comments, whatever you got. Hit me at Brandon_Warren on Twitter. Make sure you're following me. Make sure you're following at Zone Coverage MN, and make sure that you are following at John_Becker, because John is back for another trip around here on the show. John, how's it going today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. And so we can find your work on MLB Daily Dish, our MLB depth charts. What all are you up to besides that?
So I'm a freshman at Miami University, management leadership major, analytics co-major, enjoying tail end of my first semester here. And so juggling all that with all this baseball work I'm doing, but it's been a great time, having a lot of fun.
How's school treating you so far? I mean, easier than you thought, harder than you thought? Is being away from home harder than you thought? What's the general vibe?
It's been easier than I thought. Being away from home has been a little tough, obviously. You know, I haven't been away from my family this long ever, but Thanksgiving is in 3 weeks, so I'm really excited to go home and see everybody and hang out and just decompress a little.
Well, the end of baseball probably is another bit of separation anxiety inducing for a lot of us. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but let's break down that World Series. I know you are considerably younger than maybe most of our listeners, but you've been watching baseball long enough to see some pretty great World Series. I think my contention is that the best World Series of my lifetime is 1991. I'm sure you've heard that. I know you weren't alive then, but if I were to rank World Series, I think 91 is in the catbird seat, so to speak. I think last year might have been better than this year because and here's my argument. I was on a radio hit earlier today, and Game 7 carries a lot of weight. And so any series that goes less than 7 games is going to, by definition, not have as much tension on each side. So the 6 or 5 games would have to be a lot more pressure-packed and honestly probably disqualifies most series. And so then you kind of jump to the idea that Game 7 has to be pretty pressure-packed, and I think that's kind of what separates them. To me, obviously, Yu Darvish digging a fairly deep hole early took a lot of the intrigue out of this game. It was still, you know, in theory, the baseball Super Bowl, you know, winner-take-all, lose-go-home, whatever. But I just thought, you know what? I think last year's World Series was better than this one. What say you?
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, the Dodgers didn't necessarily go down quietly in their Game 7. But ultimately, they left a lot of runners on base, and they didn't ever really come close to tying up the game. They obviously never had the tying run on base after they were down 5-0. And even down 5-1, I don't think they ever got the bases loaded again. So, you know, there was never a situation where they could have just tied the game right there after the second inning. You know, it wasn't really easy cruising for any of the Astros pitchers until Charlie Morton really found a groove in the 8th and 9th.
What a story he is, by the way. If I'm shopping in free agency, I'm looking for another Charlie Morton. I don't know who it would be, and we can break that down when we get into free agency talking a little bit here. But man alive, guy who's 33 and just starts throwing gas is incredible.
I think I saw 99 from him actually, maybe in the eighth inning, and just what he's been able to do is amazing. And I think it was really fitting that the kind of one of the hallmarks of the Astros rebuild of just kind of finding diamonds in the rough as they could, along with, of course, just building from the minor leagues, was the guy to get the last out of the World Series.
Yeah. What, you know, if you were to think about all the teams that played in the postseason, and I'm not talking about ratings, I'm not talking about anything that doesn't really matter. At the beginning of the postseason, if you would have been looking for the best possible World Series, whatever your definition is, fill me in on your definition and then your process and what you think would have been the case. Where does this land on the best possible matchup in the idea that these are the two best teams to represent their leagues, and then kind of how that played out?
You know, as much as I like the underdog in getting to the playoffs, you know, I liked that the Twins kind of overcame a lot of doubters to make the playoffs. I wouldn't have liked seeing a team with so few wins in the World Series. So I think ultimately, I think having the best teams possible would have been great. And obviously, that's what we got. I think that the Dodgers, I think, far and away, best team in the National League, and I would have been happy to see either the Indians or the Astros represent the American League. I think they're about neck and neck for the best team. I think ultimately, you want to see an even match, and I think an even match between the two best teams is the best kind of even match to have.
Do you think that either of these teams were better than the other? I saw someone say that really it's just going to be whoever plays the best seven games, but frankly, these teams are probably not better than the other. It's probably pretty much straight down the middle.
Yeah, I think it was pretty straight down the middle, I think.
Which is amazing because of how differently they're crafted, too.
Right.
Astros with a shaky bullpen, a pretty good rotation, and the best offense since 1931 as far as weighted runs created plus. Whereas the Dodgers just kind of beat you over the head with a little bit of everything, really. I mean, good bullpen, good rotation, good offense. No real weaknesses outside of, you know, second base wasn't great because Logan Forsythe didn't have a great year. But they always had guys pop up. I mean, who would have ever thought they were looking for outfield depth at any point in the season, let alone late in the year with expanded rosters where Kike Hernandez is playing in the outfield or Curtis Granderson. I mean, this is a team that had probably six or seven outfielders who could start on other teams. Andrew Toles, Trace Thompson, all these guys that you kind of forget about. So, well, what the heck, Chris Taylor just comes out of not necessarily nowhere, but is, you know, he's a revelation for them. Austin Barnes basically wrestles away the catching job from Yasmani Grandal. I mean, the Dodgers, you could write a novel about this year's Dodgers team. And in addition to that crazy losing streak to begin September, I think it would be very, very compelling drama.
Yeah, I think it's right down the middle. I think that in terms of the depth and the way that the two teams were built, obviously was very different with the, you know, economic situations that they were in, and even the style of the general managers, despite, you know, both being analytical, was very different. The Dodgers making just a lot of, you know, trades and shrewd moves for a big market team, and the Astros just really trying to build up their minor league system as best as they could, and seemingly just hitting on every single guy that they put through their system, mm-hmm. turning into a great player. But man, I think that the World Series could have gone so many different ways. You know, there was just so much variability with Kershaw and Darvish. Darvish really struggled, and the Astros bullpen was really good at the beginning of the season, just kept fading, and it just hit a new low in the playoffs. And man, it could have gone either way. And I think that to say that one team or the other was better, you know, either going into the World Series or based on their performance in the World Series itself, I think would be a little bit foolish. I think that, you know, the Dodgers, despite losing, have nothing to hang their heads about. They had a great season and a great team.
And now I would say that Darvish's market's going to be pretty much affected nil by that struggle. You wouldn't be hard-pressed to find, or it wouldn't be hard for you to find a columnist online with a big Twitter following to say, oh yeah, you know, it probably cost him some millions. I don't think so. Honestly, I think whatever teams are going after him would kill to be in the position where they have to put him through the ringer in the World Series again, because that means they got there. So, MLB Trade Rumors has him 6 years, $160 million. That's not a discount, if you ask me.
No, yeah, not at all. And I think in terms of knowing what we know about the baseball, potentially having been an issue for the pitchers in the World Series.
Well, his slider, this pitch he throws the second most this year. That's a big deal for a guy like that. And, you know, Irvin Santana, too, in the wild card game, I wonder, you know, he didn't throw very many pitches, but it was a 10% dip from his previous four or five starts for slider usage. So maybe as early as that wild card game, we could have seen something was up with the baseballs made in the postseason. Because Keith Law kind of heavily intimated that all the baseballs for the postseason were made at the same time. So I think what was used in the wild card game in the World Series is probably all the same original batch.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with what Carlos Correa, I believe it was, said after the World Series that Carlos Beltran had alerted the team of Darvish tipping pitches with his glove. Obviously, if you're the Dodgers, you don't want to see a guy tipping pitches in the World Series, but that's a lot more fixable than a more serious mechanical issue or worse, him having been hurt in the World Series.
Is there a guy more Jekyll and Hyde in the game? Lows are the lowest, highs are the highest than Yu Darvish? Because honestly, here's my take. The guy throws five or six pitches from probably five or six angles, and you know, is there a guy that has more up and down potential than him? I know he's great when he's healthy, but you know, he's just again Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, I think coming into this year, that hadn't been the narrative. He had just been always really good, and this year was kind of the first year where he really struggled at times. And it seemed like tipping his pitches was just the constant issue all throughout. And I think ultimately that kind of is what makes or breaks him. And obviously throwing really, it might be eight different pitches from eight different angles. You know, you're going to have a lot of variability in starts. And I think amongst those top shelf, you know, top 30 to 50 starting pitchers in the game, he's definitely, you know, he pitches like he's the best, and he pitches like he's the worst at times.
Yeah, I think he's still going to be great, and someone's going to give him $25 million per year, and you know, assuming he stays healthy, probably be just fine with it. One thing I like to see, though, is that older players like that can pick up pitch tipping and all that. Torrey Hunter was the kind of guy who I think people believed could do that with Chris Sale the year the Twins had him back. I think it was 2015, obviously, that the Twins crushed Sale, and the widespread belief was that Torrey had picked up something, passed it on to the guys, and they hit him for like a 7.84 ERA that year. So I always like hearing about the game within the game, which is obviously very fascinating. One talking point, though, that came out, and I'm sure you have a take on it, because I think a lot of people you know, that are interested in the game do, was the rise of the concept of bullpenning. And there's no shortage of takes, but I have one. I want to hear yours first before I share it. You know, where do you stand on the idea of hashtag bullpenning in October?
I think that you need to do whatever you need to do as a team to win the game. And if that's, you know, in the opinion of either the analytics or, you know, more the gut feeling or what you're seeing as the pitching coach or the manager, you know, you have to do whatever decision you think is best. But I think that there's a big, I think there's a big gap in what you can, you know, idealize statistically and what pitchers are comfortable with. You know, is a pitcher comfortable with coming in the third inning instead of the eighth inning? Is a pitcher okay with throwing 50 pitches when he topped out at 30 pitches in the regular season? Is a starter okay with coming out of the bullpen? So I think I like the idea a lot in theory, and we've seen it work in practice a lot. But to me, it's shocking to me when people are kind of either surprised that it doesn't work, you know, throwing a starter in relief when he's never done that, or B, kind of post hoc, you know, railing on the idea of bullpenning just because it doesn't work, when, you know, if it had worked, you obviously wouldn't have been going against it. So I think that with bullpenning and with just any decision in general, it's important to, you know, think about the decision-making process and not the result.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So yeah, that's my take. I'm curious to know what you think. I think that it's a very, very tough thing to manage in the playoffs. I think obviously managing a pitching staff is going to be the toughest thing.
I think I don't know if it's begging the question, but like, yeah, you want to get the most innings you can out of a guy like Kenley Jansen because he's incredible. But if you are referring to his statistics, that's with metered, deliberate usage in the regular season. You have to consider what, you know, you know, if it's what am I trying to say here? If the loss as his innings jump is incremental to the point where, you know, he's no more effective, you know, if he throws 40 pitches one day to come back and throw another inning, like leaning on regular season statistics to dictate your postseason ideology, so to speak, to me, it just doesn't work. Again, in theory, you want your best pitchers pitching as many innings as possible, and you want to give varied looks. But if you are bringing in, let's say, Kenley Jansen in a 5-1 lead to seal off the, you know, the National League Division Series game one, because that game is very important. All these games are very important. You know, you aren't necessarily looking forward to the fact that you might also need him for game seven of the World Series. You need to win that day and then get to the next one. So while it's all hands on deck, you know, the concept of bullpenning makes sense to me, but, you know, you have a law of like declining averages as, you know, as the pitches mount on a shoulder like Jansen's, who has, again, you know, probably 50, 60 appearances over the course of the year. And not very often is he appearing 4 or 5 times in 1 week. Again, too, and this kind of harkens back to what you said, was I think it also depends on the team's strengths. You know, you're not going to bullpen if you have Clayton Kershaw and a reasonably effective Yu Darvish. You know, you're going to let Kershaw go 6 and then patch it together after that, or maybe even 7. Whereas if you're the Minnesota Twins and you have a good bullpen, but you're starting guys like Kyle Gibson, then you're going to push back more in the other direction. So I think in October, it just boils down to playing to your strengths, but also understanding that you're not operating with regular season constraints. And so if a guy, you know, Jansen showed some signs of wear and tear, gave up a home run to Marwin Gonzalez on an 0-2 cutter, it doesn't necessarily mean bad process. It just means that, you know, these things all have an effect as the postseason goes on. And so, you know, it's not as easy as just pushing a couple buttons and having, you know, automatic outs come out of your bullpen. And so I think it takes a lot of nuance, and maybe Twitter is not, you know, not the format for that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think there's an important, you know, distinction to make with bullpenning being using your bullpen a lot, and bullpenning being using your one guy who's used to throwing one inning for 3 innings.
You know, and multiple times in one series, too.
Right, and I think ultimately you need to have, you know, if you're going to bullpen, you need to have 3-4 guys you can trust to, you know, go 6 innings out of a 9-inning game for you if you need to.
Nice.
And not just 2. You know, 1 or 2. I think that it ultimately is about spreading out those innings as best as you can and not really just riding on the back of your closer for 10 innings in a 6-game, 7-game series, because ultimately that's just not going to work.
Well, let's put the World Series to bed and start talking about off-season stuff. I saw you kind of going back and forth with people on Twitter yesterday about Gabe Kapler being tabbed to manage the Philadelphia Phillies. I do have a little bit of bias that, you know, I think he's one of my favorite guys in baseball, but that's, you know, to me, it's maybe the fact that I don't know how he'll be as a manager. There's just so much I don't know. But as a person who I've met before, I you know, we're friendly. But what is kind of your takeaway from whether it was the press conference, the Heyman article, which was maybe a little bit of a hatchet job, but you know, he's getting information from inside the game, so it's not like he's making it up. You know, what was your takeaway from the Phillies making this hire? And then I'll kind of counter with, you know, maybe where I'm at as far as some of these things.
So I think what's clear, no matter what I read about Kapler, whether it's, you know, Heyman's article that was, you know, didn't put Kapler in a great light, to say the least, or whether it's, you know, an article by Ryan Lawrence of Philly Voice, just kind of laying everything that Kapler said out on the table and not giving an opinion. Mm-hmm. I think that no matter what you read, you understand that Kapler is qualified, that he's very intelligent, and that ultimately, was he the right choice? I don't know. I don't know how, you know, I don't know much about Dusty Wathan. I don't know much about how John Farrell would do in Philadelphia. But what I do know is that Kapler seems very qualified. what I was able to glean from the press conference, however, is that he's not experienced in talking to the media, which is the least important part of the job, in my opinion. Nor is he necessarily experienced in just kind of off the cuff talking to players, mm-hmm. At least based on the Heyman article. So I think in terms of in-game decisions, he's pretty ideal based on what we know about him. He's very smart. He's willing to use the analytics. You know, he's highly competitive and is willing to, you know, let's say pull a starter early just so, you know, he can get a win, doesn't care about the pitcher getting a win. But I think on perhaps the more human side of the game, I'm not necessarily convinced that he can build up a good rapport with the players, at least based on the press conference. And I think it would really behoove him to have a bench coach or a coaching staff in general filled with guys who are known for that, whether it's Dusty Baker, whether it's Dusty Wathen, who knows a lot of the guys on the team from his time managing the Phillies AA and AAA affiliates, or, you know, even whether it's just a guy who doesn't have managerial experience but has been on coaching staffs for years. I think Kapler really needs, you know, a group of guys to just show him, you know, this is how you communicate with players, this is how you communicate with the media. You know, because right now it seems like Kapler is going to write a script for every, you know, pre and post game conference with the media or with players, and that's not what you want to have happen.
Yeah, I read the thing about the teleprompter, and I guess for me, I don't know. I mean, I think when you're doing instruction, you know, maybe it's not the worst thing to be that prepared, but I do see why people are kind of up in arms about that. You know, the one thing I think about too is, you know, people will say it's, you know, analytics and might not be able to handle the game. To me, there's kind of a differing level here. It's, you know, as somebody who played in the big leagues and understands the grind, I think it would be different than if you or I at age 42 got hired. And again, you know, I played a little bit in college. I didn't play in the big leagues, minor leagues, anything close to that. But to understand the big league struggle as a player, I think will help him in this case to the point where he won't just be numbers in spots where it's not necessary or maybe there's a little more nuance needed. But I think, too, yeah, it would be smart for the Phillies to put a dream team of support staff around him, whether it's, you know, maybe get Charlie Manuel back in there as a bench coach or Dusty Baker, Dusty Wathen, like you said. You know, equal parts internal, because it's going to be a lot of young players like J.P. Crawford and Michael Franco, depending on if he hangs around. You know, I think you want to have an adequate mix of guys who can speak Spanish, because I think some of the guys are Hispanic, and I think that's a good thing to have on your staff. But also, maybe someone who's got some tenure in that organization, and then, yeah, like you said, someone like Dusty Baker, someone with some big league experience. You know, surround him with the tools to make him successful, because otherwise you're just kind of wasting your time and really going to make, you know, if this doesn't work and they haven't put all the resources around him, you know, that's going to set the quote unquote analytics back to the point now, you know, analytics is like the baseball word for millennial. And that's really unfortunate, because it's really a misunderstanding of what analytics strives to do. And so if Kapler's not successful, I feel like that's going to be a big strike against that word in the, you know, the less baseball savvy circles, whether it's on Twitter or, you know, the older columnists, the blue hair columnists, so to speak.
Right. And I think ultimately, whatever you think of Kapler, I think you do have to agree with that it's not going to be good for analytics in the future, or at least it's going to set it back if he doesn't do well. I think it's important that the guy who is seemingly going to become the most analytically inclined manager in the game, despite his prior playing experience, you know, does well. And, you know, maybe he won't be the best manager, but, you know, to at least get him, you know, give him a positive reputation, you know, in baseball circles and amongst baseball fans, whether it's on Twitter or otherwise, is really important for the, you know, future of the more analytically inclined manager. And, you know, Kapler could just be the start of, you know, maybe we'll have a better analytically inclined manager in 2019 and 2020 and so on and so forth. He doesn't have to be the end-all be-all, nor does he necessarily have to carry the torch for everyone else. I don't think he, you know, deserves to have that all that pressure on him. But ultimately, I think it's important that he, you know, at the very least does well and doesn't really get as much flack as he's been getting, unjustifiably so, in my opinion, over these last couple of days.
Well, we got to jump on the off season that the Angels had in did an extension with Justin Upton, basically tacking on another year and 18, I think it was 18 million, 18 and a half million, something like that. The structure of the deal is a little different. It's going to give them some relief on the front end in exchange for a little bit of a bump towards the back when he gets to be into his mid 30s. What was your initial thought on this Upton deal? I think, you know, obviously not great for the Tigers, who in turn didn't get a whole lot back from. I think they got an organizational player and that's about it. But for the Angels, again, you know, you really got to surround Mike Trout with talent, and this was an opportunity to do that on a deal that's, you know, I don't think it's an awful deal. I think Upton, you know, has his ups and downs, but he's a pretty solid player overall.
Yeah, I think, you know, it obviously wasn't inevitable that he would come back to the Angels, but I think that it became clear that they were obviously going to do their due diligence and really try hard to bring him back, finally having Josh Hamilton off the books. I think that it was really smart of them to restructure the contract the way they did. Billy Epler said it was really important for them to be able to do that. It probably imperative. In fact, they saved $6 million doing that, which, you know, could get them a back-end starter, a couple of bullpen guys, you know, something that they need to improve the pitching, which is going to be their next goal. And I think that by all accounts, Upton's a great clubhouse guy. And I think most importantly, he will be able to hit behind Mike Trout and not have Albert Pujols do that, which is really, really important for the Angels offense to have someone who, you know, is not in the twilight of his career struggling like Albert Pujols is, hitting right behind the best player in baseball.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, if we move into the offseason and some of the free agents that are coming up, it's, again, not the greatest free agent pool that we've seen or will see, because next year is going to be pretty terrific, but it's not bad. So, you know, we're looking at some of these lists. There's one for Roto World, one on MLB Trade Rumors. Pretty much the consensus that Yu Darvish is the number one free agent. I believe Trade Rumors has, yeah, J.D. Martinez and then Eric Hosmer. Roto World has Hosmer second. To me, Hosmer, you know, Hosmer's probably going to get more money than Martinez. But who would you rather have between those two guys? I guess it depends on need, but I feel like I'd rather have J.D. Martinez. Is that a weird take or not really?
No, I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer. I'd rather have J.D. Martinez. He's just been so, so good for, I think, 4 years running now.
Yeah.
And while Hosmer's been more durable, I think that there's not really any, like, lingering injury concern with Martinez anyway. And while Martinez isn't great defensively, Hosmer isn't either, and Martinez, you know, is a slightly below average player at a more premium position, which is right field, than Hosmer being a slightly below average player at a, you know, the easiest position to play. Mm-hmm. To me, I think that Hosmer, despite coming off the best season of his career, is going to be overpaid. I think that he still had very high ground ball tendencies. And ultimately, you know, with the home run spike being the way it is, seeing him only hit 25 home runs as a first baseman, you know, it still leaves a lot to be desired.
Do you think a different hitting coach can swing that with him and change it?
Yeah.
I haven't looked to see if a lot of players have the ability to change that much, but it's interesting theory, you know, to change it. Because obviously mechanical changes at that age are not going to be easy, but that would make him into a legit superstar possibly.
Yeah. I mean, I think we saw with Daniel Murphy being the prime example.
Josh Donaldson, I think, was a elevate guy too.
Yeah, Josh Donaldson, Daniel Murphy, even J.D. Martinez were all, you know, just guys who started to elevate their swings. You know, that was to turn them more from line drives into fly balls. Hosmer, you know, going ground balls to fly balls is going to be a little bit more difficult. But I think ultimately, yeah, you know, hitting coach, I don't know who, maybe it's just anyone, but the one he was working with in Kansas City could just kind of unlock his swing, add a few more home runs, and I think more importantly than add a few more home runs, eliminate the ground balls that are automatic outs with, well, A, his speed, and B, the shift.
It's going to be an issue, though, I guess, with the money. You know, Hosmer getting the deal will probably be willing to make changes because he's already got that money coming to him, but then does the team view that as risky, changing who he is at this point with, let's just say, hypothetically, 6 years on a deal? Do you think it's a kind of chance the team will be, you know, likely to take, or, you know, where do you stand on that?
You know, I think it very much depends. If it's something that, you know, maybe it's just known within the industry that if Hosmer does X, Y, and Z, he's going to hit more fly balls, then yeah, you do it. Now, if it's every team has a different view, or some people or some teams are just like, oh, that's just how he is, then yeah, you're going to have some issues. So I'm going to say, I'm going to kind of cap out and say, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But to me, there have been so many hitting coaches been able to unlock launch angle in so many different players lately that I'd give it a shot.
When you look at position player free agents, who are some of the ones that intrigue you the most in terms of whether it's what kind of fit they'll find, what kind of dollars they'll get, or, you know, just anything that's intriguing to you when you break them down about potential for where they're headed?
Let's see. Well, I mean, you're not going to find a lot of intrigue in the top of the market, I guess.
Right. For me, like Eduardo Nunez, because of how many positions he plays, got hurt in the, I think, the Cleveland series, had to get carried off the field. But, you know, there's value there. It's kind of funny to see how he's come full circle from being a mess in New York to pretty good with the Twins, pretty good with the Giants, pretty good with the Red Sox. You know, I think the ability to move all around the field has value, even if he's not a great defender wherever he goes. So, you know, that's one guy I'm going to keep an eye on. Another is going to be Carlos Santana. I think the Indians would really like to get him back. But I tell you what, if a team is in need and misses out on Hosmer, I'd almost rather have Santana, frankly. Just I think the approach is better.
Yeah, for the price, you know, for the value per dollar, I think you're going to get a much better deal with Santana. I mean, Santana, maybe the best plate discipline out of anyone in baseball, not named Joey Votto, over the past 5 years or so, whereas, you know, Eric Hosmer doesn't really take his walks. He likes to swing.
Mm-hmm. If hypothetically the Twins signed Santana to DH, or, you know, mix and match at first base with Joe Mauer and bat leadoff, that's kind of the dream scenario for this team, because, you know, Brian Dozier leading off is not ideal. He should probably hit third or second or fourth or whatever. But a lineup atop the order, which is Santana, Mauer, Dozier, Sano, that's going to score some runs, let me tell you.
Yeah, that's going to be, you know, as good as any top four in the game, and hopefully, you know, you continue to see Jorge Polanco improve, Byron Buxton improve,
really
Max
nice
Kepler
player.
Bounces back.
Yep. Eddie Rosario had a really nice year. I don't think people Minnesota realized he was like 122 OPS plus, I think.
Yeah, he had a great season. I think, you know, the Twins are one of those teams just one, you know, solidly above average player away from having a really good offense, and of course, you know, continued improvement from from Buxton and Rosario and Polanco and hopefully a bounce back from Max Kepler. Now that's a lot of ifs, but I like their offense, and I think having a guy like Santana that's just really just a pure plate discipline, power, good at bat guy, would be really great for them.
What about Lorenzo Cain? I'm kind of intrigued by where he ends up as well. I think, you know, he's not as young as people think. He's 30, going on 31 here to start next season. But I tell you, really good defender. We'll see if he can continue to do that. But I don't know. I think that, you know, he's a nice player. Kansas City is going to be gutted by this offseason. It's really unbelievable. And it's I guess, for Royals fans, too bad. But Kane is another guy I'm keeping an eye on.
Yeah, I think, you know, ultimately it depends on is he willing to play a corner or not. Now, he's still a great center fielder, but he'd be an absolutely elite right fielder. And obviously, if he's going to have more openings and thus potentially more money, if he's willing to play in an outfield corner. But, you know, the way I see it, I think that the consistency that he's put up over the past few years and just how athletic he is, I don't really see a steep decline coming for him, even if you do sign him to a four or even five-year deal.
What about starting pitchers? I mean, everybody knows about Darvish, Masahiro Tanaka, Jake Arrieta. Tanaka, assuming he opts out, of course. But what starting pitchers are you keeping an eye on? I know for me, you know, I think Lance Lynn, you know, that first year back from TJ surgery was not perfect. You know, the FIP is pretty ugly. But the second year back is going to be interesting. I have a lot of trust in him to bounce back. He'll only be 30 next year. Tyler Chatwood's numbers outside Coors are fairly interesting, but, you know, the peripherals are not pretty no matter where you have them. So I don't know. He's got some potential. And then, you know, it's a lot of other names that are just kind of blah, really. Mike Minor opted out today. Jaime Garcia at the back end of a rotation is not the worst idea. You know, are any of these guys, you know, doing anything for you?
I think this might be the most kind of mysterious pitching, starting pitching market in a while. You know, even the top guys, Darvish and Arrieta, have really taken their lumps this past season. You know, Tanaka.
Yeah, especially away from, Tanaka had like a 6+ ERA away from Yankee Stadium.
But in terms of upside, I mean, you've got a lot. Chatwood's got the velocity. Lance Lynn's got the velocity. And you know, could.
Oh, I didn't even mention Alex Cobb either, Tommy John survivor.
What's interesting is that Alex Cobb might be the most, might be the safest bet of anybody on the free agent market, you know, in terms of how quickly he was able to bounce back after surgery and how much like his former self he looked.
Do you think his stuff will come back further to where he can strike out 8 batters per 9, or is he a 6.5 to 7.5 guy now?
I mean, to me, he lives and dies with his changeup, and ultimately, if he gets just a little bit more depth back on that changeup like he had before the surgery, which, you know, I don't see why he couldn't.
It's a better bet than if he was a slider or curveball guy, though, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's a lot harder to kind of build back your breaking ball after Tommy John, whereas changeup seems to be more of a grip thing that he just might not have been, you know, quite back to just after not having picked up a baseball for so long. But I think that Cobb is very intriguing. I think that Julie Chassin, who was great at in Petco Park, especially this past season, is very intriguing. I think that
even deep down the list, I mean, there's some there's some names. Juan Nicasio is going to be really interesting. There's some pretty good relievers. I don't think anybody that's going to get maybe $10 million isn't out of the option, out of the potential realm of possible, I guess. But you know, Mike Minor, I'm really interested to see if he signs as a starter or a reliever. But you know, it's just intrigue, and whoever can kind of separate the wheat from the chaff is going to maybe have a really good windfall here.
Right. I think that's what it is. It's just, you know, it's a lot of luck. It's a lot of, you know, what do you see in a player that you really like that other teams might not see or just aren't willing to pay as much for as you are. And it's just a lot of, it's a lot of guessing with the starting pitching market. You know, the way that that pitching in baseball works is that even the best pitchers are going to have their clunkers, and you're just going to figure out, you know, who's going to have the fewest clunkers or who's the best bet to get better. And, you know, that's what it comes down to, really.
Well, John, that's all we have for you today. How about we plan to have you back on as some of these guys start coming off the board for a little bit of analysis and some breakdowns on the fits? How do you feel about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I can't wait for it to get going, and there's going to be a lot of action, trade market, free agent market, and I'd be more than happy to come back and discuss all that.
Well, you got it. It's at @JohnBecker_ on Twitter. Thanks for joining us, man. Check out his work on MLB Daily Dish. You've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Zone Coverage Podcast Network.